safety is a word that gets bandied about San Francisco these days in terms of like, you know, people's sense of safety, and seeing a person experiencing homelessness makes them feel unsafe, and seeing a person using drugs makes them feel unsafe. And the conclusion being that in order to have more safety, you need more policing and you need more security and you need all of these things to keep, you know, the people who are housed safe from the people who are unhoused and frankly poor.
Homelessness is not a crisis that can be fixed overnight, but solutions do exist. Yet the real challenge is how we approach these solutions. Fast fixes and quick visibility often fail to address the deeper needs of the homeless population. True change comes through long-term sustainable policies and the dedication to building real relationships with those affected. Welcome back to part two of our Finding Home Live show, which is part of our Making the Invisible Visible series. In part two, we'll continue to explore how community-based solutions, coupled with compassion and time, can lead to meaningful progress. By looking at both the structural and human elements of homelessness, we'll see that lasting change is possible, but it requires the patience to understand complex realities and the commitment to invest in people and their futures. Seeing our unhoused neighbors not as problems to be solved, but as individuals deserving of our empathy and respect.
Now there's a new movement to basically not allow people to live in their cars or their RVs. So I'm going to turn to Sammy and have her share a little bit about solutions you've seen done, what you'd like to see.
Yeah, touching back to the pandemic, there were plenty of challenges, but there was this just like community response that got everyone to one table. And we were able to see some results, particularly women who had formerly been in our drop-in center. A life cycle of like how a woman might engage the homeless service system very often looks like, and sadly, coming in, doing one of our programs. You know, we're not the only women's service provider. There's many. There are others in the city, but you might be in kind of a cocoon of a gender-specific space. And then get the golden ticket, get into housing, but because you're in a single resident occupancy, an SRO, and you're sharing bathrooms with other genders, we have this time and again where all this investment will go into a woman getting herself stable, getting into housing, and she's reassaulted in that housing and then falls back. And so having investments, and what we're really focused on is how can we make those movements safe and permanently safe? And in the pandemic, we saw, you know, just the increases of hygiene, mental health, just overall, you know, well-being of the women being in this kind of, again, this cocoon of, you know, having their own bed and their own room. We were able to see a huge uptick, you know, almost 70% of those women moved on into permanent housing because they were able to build that stability over several years. And so we want to continue to see that kind of progress. One of the kind of strategic things we've done is really focused on coalition building. So we're one of the co-founders of the Women's Housing Coalition. And you know, so much of the homeless response is community-based, right? It's, you know, there's different responses in different neighborhoods, different responses for different racial groups within women. And so what we're working on at Community Forward is like, how can we build a tent for all of these different services so that a woman falling into this system doesn't need to necessarily understand, you know, what's the difference between Mary Elizabeth Inn or La Casa de las Madres or Asian Women's Shelter. You know, there's so many wonderful programs, Safe House, that what we want to see and where we see our response, because we are that safety net, we're that drop-in center that, you know, we, in a given year, we might see 3,000 women in our door. And so to be that role, we really want to move into our vision of a women's center, which would be a one-stop shop, a place where we can really refer and connect women to their next place in their journey, whether that's with us or with others. So we really push, you know, one of the things we'd love to see is Proposition A is a funding source that was passed last year. So that those funds will be issued sometime in the next year. And there's a historic $30 million carved out for victim and survivor housing. So our aim is to see that really make a big dent in the long-term safety of women within our homeless service system. And I guess one other note to add and kind of echoing Lydia is that the population is aging. We are seeing that's the fastest growing homeless population is older adults. And just looking at truly permanent solutions, these are women who aren't necessarily going to go back and get a job and be able to, you know, have a short-term subsidy that works for them. So we really want to see long-term solutions for older adults as well.
So just following back up, so Proposition A?
That has already passed.
Already
so it's
passed.
Just getting that out the door. But I'd say just in general, voters looking at any investments we can make in housing. And like Erica said, the whole all of it is needed, transitional, permanent, the whole mix is needed.
Education centers, more, you know, Project Gupios, et cetera. So anything anyone can do to write to get money accelerated coming out of Project A?
Just continuing to, you know, elevate the need to your local supervisors that, you know, when we do all this, you know, work to get these big propositions passed, just making sure that those dollars get out the door and get invested in the community.
Great. Thank you, Sam. Megan?
Yeah, I mean, I echo what everyone has said. And, you know, I would also emphasize what I see a lot that can feel challenging to me, as I've seen in San Francisco, as I've been here the last 12 years, is people want very quick solutions. They want the visibility of homelessness to change, and they want it to happen very quickly. And frankly, that's not realistic. But when we make decisions for our community based on what can make this look different or be different quickly, well, then it's not going to be lasting. Houston just reported a 63% decrease in homelessness because they made a housing first initiative. They did that in 2012. It takes time, but it works. A really wonderful article came out where a woman who was a disabled 80-year-old veteran, and she has housing for the first time in decades because of this policy. Now, it would be unrealistic and frankly cruel to say that this person needs to go find income that can provide housing. She, you know, she has served her community in her life. Not that I think that that's a necessity to get housing, but it just shows that it works. But it takes time, right? That was 12 years ago they made that policy, and only now are they reporting the 63% decrease. So we need to believe that these policies that take time are the ones that are going to be the most effective often. I mentioned that I ran an interim housing program in Chicago. That program had been around for 40 years. And we thought, wow, 40th anniversary, we should celebrate this. So we did a little bit of a media blitz, and we invited all the neighbors to come into our site and see what we were doing. Big lesson learned from one of my first roles in the sector. A petition began. Don't bring a shelter to our neighborhood. This is Lincoln Park. This is a nice neighborhood. There's no homelessness here. We don't want a shelter here. And I had to say, you know, to this petition was getting hundreds of signatures. And I had to be like, ma'ams, sirs, we are here. You're trying to prevent us from coming here. But the reason why you don't see homelessness in your neighborhood is because we are here, because we have provided people with a safe space, a roof over their head. It was interim housing with no deadline. And as long as, you know, people were working on their goals with their case managers, they had the safe space. And so I think we need to stop with this language of don't bring this here to my area because we don't want homelessness here. Well, you have homelessness in your neighborhood. And we also agree that I don't want someone sleeping on your stoop any more than they want to have to be sleeping on your stoop. So we need to believe in these solutions that do take more time, not the ones that just end things in 3 months. Really invest. Care about San Francisco. You know, have like that city pride that I think is so important. And we also, I would really love to see us get away from us as a, you know, the royal us, not us up here, but this language that people are choosing not to accept shelter. I have been doing this for quite a while. I've met a lot of people. I've never, ever met anyone decline shelter that wasn't a poor option for them, that wasn't a less safe option than what they were doing. In fact, this person we met recently, he was offered a shelter bed. And he'd been sleeping outside, and you would think, phenomenal, a shelter bed. Why wouldn't you take that? Well, the shelter he was offered, it was a bunk bed, the top bunk, and he is in a wheelchair. So he said, that's not a good option for me, and they marked it off as declined shelter. And so it broke my heart to hear it. So yeah, I think it's just really echoing what everyone said and just giving my own examples to it. But having a safe place to be, that is a space that fits that person's needs, is the solution. And we have to be willing to invest the money and the time in doing that.
Thank you. And Lydia?
I mean, I want to echo universal basic income. I mean, there's something bigger happening across the world, which is that, you know, our economy is changing and the way people work is changing and how many jobs there are is changing. And so whether we like it or not, the canaries in the coal mine around homelessness and joblessness has to do with a bigger economy. And so universal basic income at some point needs to become, you know, established.
Second, because just for everybody in the audience and folks listening and watching, your project provides Hand Up to folks that are participating. So on Hand Up, there is a Gupio where people can actually, yes. So I'll send you the information, but it looks like there's folks that have created a Hand Up campaign for folks who've been in your program.
Oh, wonderful.
So,
yeah. I think that's...
You have a Hand Up expert here, so yeah. Maybe there's an opportunity to do that.
Amazing. Yeah, I think that it's interesting when we talk about safety. You know, safety is a word that gets bandied about San Francisco these days in terms of, like, you know, people's sense of safety. And seeing a person experiencing homelessness makes them feel unsafe. And seeing a person using drugs makes them feel unsafe. And the conclusion being that in order to have more safety, you need more policing and you need more security and you need all of these things to keep, you know, the people who are housed safe from the people who are unhoused and frankly poor. And I just want people to have a reality check. You know, when we look at the overdose crisis, where you had 813 people in 2023 die on the streets of San Francisco and in shelters and SROs and homes, the person who was unsafe on the street was the person who was using drugs, not the person walking by them. The safety of the people who are experiencing homelessness is far more at risk than the person who's walking by them. You know, and I ran the safety team for St. Anthony's for many years. And I learned something. I feel like safety teams often make people unsafe. And the reason is because when we increase policing, it creates an environment where someone needs to be in confrontation with another person, you know, and it creates this environment where, you know, if you live out on the street, I used to always say to my team, I was like, you know, you got to give people space to be able to walk out, because you're not going to walk into the street feeling like a mouse. You're going to hit the street feeling like a lion, right? So if you create an environment where you're asking someone to leave a program because their behavior is unsafe or unacceptable for the community, right? You have to give them that person space to be able to walk out on their own. I think one of the things that needs to change, again, it's really hard, but I like people need to take a good hard look at, like, what is safety, you know? And when you see someone who's acting out on the street, who's having, you know, a mental health crisis, you know, I watched a guy who was having a mental health crisis walking down the middle of Julian, which is the street that we're on. And there was a police car behind him on their speaker saying, get out of the road, while this person is walking down the street screaming and yelling. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, well, that's helpful. That's a good de-escalation technique. Like, you know, that person's behavior went from not good to, like, really crazy, you know, because they're being yelled at on a speaker in the middle of the street, right? What can the city do? Hot team does great work when they're funded. Crisis team is a great idea. You know, conserving people is complicated. But more importantly, where's the infrastructure once the person has been connected, right? Crisis team picks someone up on Valencia Street who's acting out on the street. They de-escalate that person. They'll bring them to us. We give them a place to rest. at the end of the day, they're back on the street, right? We don't have the ability to say this person who's having a mental health crisis needs a safe place to be for a while. You know, a person who has means, who has money, who is struggling with substance use disorder, sees a psychiatrist, sees a clinical psychologist, sees a, you know, treatment looks different. Abstinence-only, faith-based, social model treatment programs are often the programs that are free to people. They're great for some folk, but folks that need like clinical care, you know, it's a different level of care. Where is that care being provided? Where's the medication being provided? If someone has a mental health crisis and needs to be on medication, they're living on the street, where are they getting their medication? Where are they keeping their medication? When there's a sweep and that everything is taken, their medication is gone. Now you have a person who is floridly psychotic because they're not on their medication anymore. You know, so the infrastructure isn't there. And that's why I keep talking about the big money. It's like, where's the infrastructure? We're going to conserve people. Where are they going to go?
Thank you. Any
that's not really a solution.
No, it's great. It reminds me, actually, in 2014, as part of our show, it was a three-parter called Homeless in San Francisco. Back in 2014, when we first interviewed Semi, we also interviewed Emily Cohen, who is the acting director of Project Homeless Connect, and she had mentioned a study, and I'm trying to remember back, but the study was on for every year that someone is unhoused and living in the open, they lose around 10% of their cognitive ability. So then I think the city and county of San Francisco says that if you've lived in the street for 3 years, you're a chronic unhoused person. So let's say that you've lost 60% of your capacity, your cognitive capacity to have a conversation, to ask for help, to, you know, not walk down the street screaming, you know, et cetera. So.
And this is one of the reasons why drop-ins, you know, are part of are a stepping stone to a solution. Because people can't always come right off the street into a housing facility, right? I worked with one gentleman. He's been on the street for 18 years. Honestly, he was one of those people that I'd be like, this person's never going to be housed, right? Like they have so much of that street culture kind of in their veins and their behavior is problematic and they have substance use disorder. They have mental health. They have all kinds of stuff and they have a specific area they like to. But after 3 years of coming to us almost every day, right? We started to have these conversations. I'm like, what are the barriers? Like, why don't you live inside? Oh, I need to live on a roof. I need the open sky. You know, I'm like, oh, I don't think anyone's going to give you housing on a roof. You know what I mean? But the conversations continued. Like, what are the things you'd like? Oh, you know, he's really into music. He's really into this. He's really into, you know, and you start building this rapport. Then talking with the folks from the BEST team, which is a combination of DPH and the HOT team, you know, we were like, you know, I can get you, he can get a radio. He can, like, we started like building this narrative of what housing could look like to him. You know, he is now housed, but it took 3 years, right? It took 3 years of conversation. To your point about this is not a, the quick fixes don't exist. The people who the folks in San Francisco see on the streets acting out that are considered to be really problematic, right? And people are referring to as scary, are the most complicated folks, right? They need a lot of care. But spaces like Gubbio, what's nice about what we do for them is that it's optional. They come in when they're not, you can go through your bag 450 times, you know, and they tend to come in pretty aggressive. But after a couple of times, you know, they start to slow down. And they realize we're not going to bug them. And then they're like, oh, okay. A couple weeks later, we can start having conversation, you know? And then partnering with other organizations who are already doing the work, we're able to connect them to services by bringing organizations to them, right? Having them on site instead of referring out.
Thank you, Lydia. And Mary, coming to you.
Well, I just want to ditto what we've heard so far on the panel. There's been some incredible ideas and solutions put forth. I think, like, going back to the pandemic, just some of the things, what do we learn and trying to continue to implement those moving forward? So one thing is around the funding streams. Funders were creating an opportunity for there to be more flexibility and less restrictions and on how you were using the funds. They were kind of like moving away from sometimes their organizational missions and really were drawing to like, what is the community needing and trying to provide the opportunity for the organizations and the community to define what that is. And also the requirements and, you know, reporting requirements were often streamlined and tried to made more easy, creating more simple processes. And I think pulling those through would be a real positive thing on like, how do we continue to make it easy? And the funding to meet the needs of the community, I think, is an incredibly important thing. And then I think we, which has already been mentioned on the panel so far, is just really this cross-sector collaboration. I think if we look at housing and homelessness just in one silo, you're really not able to address the full individual and the full solution. So the more that we can start to go across systems and bring people together across public health, healthcare, education, DV, mental health, homelessness, that the more effective our approach will be in being able to solve the homeless problem. And being able to translate across, like, what do we mean by this factor across the different systems? Because each one has its own language and own complexity. At Miracle Messages, what we've been looking at doing, so we were able to, we've had an incredible gift from a family that's been able to support us in continuation of our services with a basic income. And as we were starting to grapple with, like, how do we want to continue to meet the need and expand our services? We were really looking at, like, what are our fundamental priorities and principles as an organization? And one of those was about not increasing, being really careful about minimizing the increase in our staffing infrastructure and looking at the opportunity to get the money into the hands of the community as much as possible. And so we've been looking at employing ambassadors, people with lived experience to help us do outreach in different communities. We've been also like piloting and testing different kind of financial incentives to engage and enroll into our services, but really with like, or potentially partner with and potentially provide funding to local organizations to help provide some outreach for us versus us trying to like enhance or like increase our staffing infrastructure. There's so much already that's happening across the community. And the other thing that I would suggest, you know, moving forward and thinking about like, how do we continue to do this is really getting to know individuals who are experiencing homelessness and understanding the complexity around that. And so we've talked a lot about people who are on the streets homeless, but that is just like the tip of the iceberg around homelessness. And it is such a complex situation and people's experiences vary drastically. And I think the more we are able to understand that complexity allows for us to understand what those solutions might look like moving forward. And then the last thing that I'll really say is that we need to hear what people are saying that they need and create solutions around that. And so if people are needing potable water, then we need to provide them with that. Or the people are looking for having a job, that we don't need to categorize that. Like, we can start to put away our own judgment and maybe provide them with the opportunity that they're putting in front of us versus us telling them, no, you need to go get treatment before you get a job. But how do we start meeting people with where they are and identifying and providing them with the services that they're needing? So, yeah.
Thank you, Mary. I just want to conclude this portion of it by where each organization is going. So a big part of our unhoused community and sadly poverty in general is, you know, basically racism and people of color. So, you know, what I'd love to hear from each of our organizations is how you're working to diversify your workforce and to bring in more people, you know, of color and more LGBTQ and trans folks to work with the community that's on the street that reflects that. So I'm going to start with Sammy.
Yes, thank you, George. And such an important question. And I think for us at Community Forward, really it's like, how are we supporting future leaders? And less in a like savior way and specifically in an empowerment way. And that really looks like having, like for us, over 80% of promotions of our mid-level management are all promotions from within the organization. And so when we talk with funders, we're not just talking about what we're doing in the community and support of our clients, but we're also saying, how are we mirroring that within our staff? Because if our staff are, you know, if we want to say we value lived experience and we want to say that we value our staff coming from the community, we have to provide tools and provide pathways to grow into leadership and to grow into the organization. And so, yeah, a big initiative for us has been just like management training pathway. And it's really been amazing. Just in the last 5 years, we've rebranded the organization and had new leadership. And to just see this, you know, folks who've been at the organization for 20 years and to move up and up and up to where, you know, one of our chief executives has come all the way from a frontline position and really to match investments in education and in training opportunities, because it's, you can't make good decisions unless those decisions are rooted in the community that actually has walked the experience. And it needs, but it needs many voices to make good decisions, I guess I'll say, like trained licensed clinicians and, you know, business folks and folks from the community. And so I think creating structures in your organization that value and put worth on all different types of experiences, getting opportunity, I think is really important.
Thank you, Sammy. Would any of the other panelists like to talk a little bit about what they've envisioned? Megan?
Next. Yeah, I think that's really important. I do want to talk about a program that Simply the Basics has created in the last year. It's called the Hygiene Bank Association. We were really recognizing that there's a lot of services across the country that do provide hygiene care. And these are mostly small community-based organizations. And in creating this, we kind of created a coalition, a network of all of us working together to support one another, to uplift one another. I do reflect that our, you know, 20% of executive positions in nonprofits are held by people of color. And so I think you can see that a lot of work needs to be done. You can see it here on this panel, that a lot of work still really needs to be done. In addition to that, Black-led organizations receive $8 for every $100 of philanthropic giving. That's horrifying. So one action, and it's only one, and we do continue to learn and grow and try to do better. We are a two-person organization, staff-wise, we're mostly volunteer-based. But so Simply the Basics has developed grants that we provide to all of our network Hygiene Bank Association members are eligible. However, we prioritize those that are led by people of color. We prioritize those in rural communities that don't otherwise get much funding, and we prioritize Black-led organizations to receive those grants that we fundraise for, that we know that we have had opportunities to have accessible, and we want to make sure that that becomes accessible to all of our leaders, our co-leaders in this work.
Thank you. Who else? Lydia?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important is that often the work that's done by people who have skills that you cannot learn in school, people with lived experience, are underpaid and don't have a living wage and often have to work two jobs. And so one of the things that was really important post-pandemic when we reopened the Gubbio project was, and the reason we stayed so small in some ways, is that we wanted to make sure that we were paying a living wage and that we didn't grow outside of our ability to be able to hire staff at a living wage, make sure that they have insurance, make sure that they have time off, make sure that they have all of the things that transition them to a healthy life. The folks that work at Gubbio, you know, we all came from somewhere, but those folks that we try to hire, people who have lived experience. And then the way we do training is based on skill base, right? Skill based and not trying to put someone in a box, but rather look at who they are and what they bring to the table. And then build up those skills, you know, give them some stability around what they do well. And once we have that, you know, then start growing those edges that need to be grown. It takes being able to be really engaged with your staff, you know, and to really sort of support them through supervision, you know, and building up. And also, you know, knowing that when you're working with people who have, you know, a history of drug use or, you know, a history of homelessness, that there is a mental health issue that needs to be addressed as well, right? Like a person may resume use. What do you do when a person resumes use? You know, how do you respond to that? Do you respond to that by saying that they have to stop or they lose their job? Like, do you push them back out onto the street? You know, or do you support them through what they're going through? You know, and there's a philosophy of care that has to come. I feel like, you know, you build the community with your staff that you want reflected in the service that you provide. But I do think in terms of leadership, it's like you grow it, you know, and you bring to the table, you bring people up behind you. I started as a volunteer 20 years ago, you know, with very little work experience, you know, and still cleaning bathrooms. It drives me crazy, but I'm always like, I get the biggest paycheck, I'll clean up the biggest mess. And when I get that call, I'm like, oh God, But yeah, it becomes more challenging as the operations get bigger, right? And the operations get bigger and you have a development. The folks in development get almost the highest payrolls, right? And how many people of color are in your development program? Right. And the foundations, again, I come back to like when you're asking for money from foundations that have a lens in a certain area, that's why you get $8 on the hundred.
Thank you. Anyone else? Mary?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been with Miracle Messages now for 10 months and really looking at the DEIB practices within our organization and understanding how we are addressing racial equity at every level of our organization. From the board composition, the staffing composition, the volunteer composition, the individuals that are being served, and ultimately, are we having the impact on the most impacted community members that are being served? So really, and looking at the data, looking at it through practices and policies, looking at the data, looking at it through race and ethnicity, and being able to ask ourselves the really difficult question, like, I mean, I have this belief that no data is good data. And so even if it tells you the story that you're wanting it to tell you, you need to ask really difficult questions if you're actually having the impact that you're desiring. So we're fundamentally like looking at the organization through those practices. But since we've started, we've been able to implement a Miracle Messages Advisory Council. So we have the first council right now being recruited with people with lived experience who are going to be paid for their time to provide advising on us on the strategy that we're making and decisions, difficult decisions that we're making as an organization. We've also looked at pay equity across the staff positions and understanding who's getting paid what and what the composition of the staff, racial, ethnic, LGBT, et cetera. Like we're taking that into consideration around their salary. And then also the other thing that we've been looking at is people taking time off, that our employees who are often working, they are very vision and mission driven individuals. That, and they are used to working around the clock, but that doesn't fuel them. And that we're really starting to establish boundaries where they can take off time and they're not going to be like pinged for doing that so that they can be able to make sure that they're like the healthiest person that they can be when they're coming in. So
thank you, Mary.
You're listening to Voices of the Community. And we've heard from our panelists that homelessness requires long-term solutions. And after the break, we'll explore how community partnerships and policies are beginning to create real change. This discussion is only possible through the backing of these wonderful sponsors and by viewers and listeners like you who believe in building a more inclusive and compassionate society. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. Voices of the Community is also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. Welcome back. In the second half of our conversation, we'll focus on how our panelists and their organizations are driving change, from innovative housing models to community collaborations. We'll explore the solutions that are helping people find stability and hope.
Some of the same things, I know, just starting with, as a white leader, I know I have to lead from a place of deep, deep humility. I have to lean upon my staff, the majority of whom are of color, especially because, you know, almost 90% of the families that we serve are BIPOC. We are fortunate at Compass to be able to have a full-time director of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging on staff. And, you know, he and I work closely on all sorts of things to try to create a work environment where everyone feels comfortable, wants to be. We have some similar things like management training. Most of our managers wind up working their way up from, you know, starting as a case manager or a teacher. And, you know, recognizing like it's great to promote people, but if you don't give them the skills and the support that they need, then it's sort of a disaster for everyone. So really investing in all of that. But I think a lot of it goes to the wage thing. You know, if you can't pay people a living wage, and what's a living wage in San Francisco? It's a lot. We don't actually pay people what a real living wage is. We have great benefits. We have like fully funded healthcare for our staff and their children, which I think is unusual. Our other benefits are really great, but like, you know, we have government contracts. We're like 80% government funded. We have 200 employees and, you know, we do our best, but it's not actually good enough. And then, you know, there's the issue that government workers, especially since the pandemic, are making a lot more money than any of our staff. And most of them are working from home, and our staff have to come into the office every day. So that is difficult. And then we have a family advisory committee that I'm really proud and excited of how that has turned out. You know, you can have an advisory board of clients that is sort of just kind of like you're checking a box. And this has been really exciting and really great. It's been like a whole program, and there's a lot of learning to be advocates. And actually, you know, they all went and met with all the supervisors and the head of Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, and we give them a stipend to participate. So something that we need and we lean on, but, you know, that we're not just asking them to do that, you know, out of the goodness of their hearts. So.
Thank you, Erica. So now is the time we're going to turn to the audience for folks to ask questions. And since we are videotaping this and audiotaping it, I'm going to come down and ask you to step to the white tape.
Okay. My question to y'all is, how do you work together and as organizations doing good work? What are the kind of the limitations of working cross-organizationally? And what is the capacity like for you? What are the challenges that come with that?
Thank you. And your name?
So that way we can get it on film.
My name's Imani.
And are you with an organization?
Yes, I am with Miracle Messages. It's a pleasure to meet all of you today.
Thank you, Imani. Who would like to take the question?
I can speak to it a little bit because
go ahead.
Simply the Basics is a formal partner with every organization here. So the way Simply the Basics is so efficient often is we distribute to service sites where people are already going to get services. We provide different supplies to every service site that becomes a receiving site of ours. So the ways that we provide to our receiving sites is we every quarter send the items requested. So that can be in bulk for a lot of our outreach teams. It might be in a reusable hygiene kit, or you can make a request for a specific client's needs. So if somebody needs, you know, toothpaste for dentures or a different type of shampoo, you can put in that request to us and we send it directly to your client. We host public hygiene markets at the service sites. We bring all the hygiene there. For every 50 people there, we would probably bring like 5,000 products. So there's a lot of choices. So there's a lot of options there. But we do consider this not a donation to the organizations, but a partnership. The organizations we're working with, you are our connection to people that you're already serving. We let people know about your services. We have you on a hygiene locator on our website. They can search on the hygiene locator and say, I need diapers and I'm Spanish speaking and I need a place that's ADA compliant and also would be great to get some free legal support. And you search by that and it filters to the closest organization in your area where they provide that. It's also helpful for donors who are looking for somewhere to donate products. You can search as a donor to see where to drop off. But we do ask our partners every year, have we saved you time? Have we saved you money? Have we helped you work on your client's goals? Which is how we learn that we've saved them an hour, average 8 hours a week, which is really great. But I truly love working with partnerships. We have had over 80 receiving sites in the Bay Area. This is where we were founded. One of our very first ones was at Community Forward's Drop-In Center, where we met a director there. I met her, I sat with her, and I was just kind of helping her sort through this like big room of a mess of donations. And it took us hours, and I kind of asked her, I was like, so what actually is your background here? And she said, well, I have a doctorate degree with a focus on substance abuse. And I was like, girl, get out of here. Like, what are you doing with me? I can sort tampons, you go do your job. And that kind of started this idea that we can use volunteers and community members to help the organization staff work on their goals. So these partnerships are crucial, and I'm just really grateful that we have the trust of the organizations to do that.
Thank you, Megan. And Lydia?
Yeah, so we have, you know, are partnering with a purpose program, and I think it's been vital to what we do. And it's something that we really learned during COVID. During COVID, I was working as the manager of the dining room at St. Anthony's, you know, and congregate eating sites had to shut. And so we went from overnight from being, you know, a congregate eating site to sort of a food factory where we produced food that was packaged and was able to go out the door. But also people who are in SROs who would come to eat in the dining room could no longer come in, right? So we had to create these systems, and speaking with all the other agencies that are food providers, you know, and coming up with a plan, we were able to like get food into the hands of the folks who were either in shelter hotels or in SROs and encampments and all these kind of things, things that we would have always said, oh yeah, no, that's something that we won't be able to bridge that gap, right? So, and then partnering with the city for things like fresh water. Like there was no, for people who weren't housed or weren't sheltered, there was no fresh water, right? Porta potties, things like that. All the things, you know, people think that, oh, people all went into the SIP hotels. Well, that's not the case. The vast majority of the people were still on the street. And that's how these big encampments kind of developed, is human nature to come together and providing people with water and stuff like that. So partnership was very much sort of at the forefront of our mind when we reopened Gubbio at St. John's. And building good partnerships is about building good relationships, you know. And in San Francisco is a very relational city. I feel like if you want to get something done, you kind of, you have to know the process, but then also having a name at the other end of it is so important, right? So what's really great is like building these relationships with people who are already doing the work, whether it's street medicine or it's, you know, the women's drop-in shelter, being able to provide space. Like, you know, we have women who come into our program who don't want to, you know, don't know where to go at night. Like, and we'll walk them over, you know, so, and we build these relationships. So having the relationship, I think, is key when we talk about doing a warm handoff. It should never be like a piece of paper with an address scribbled on the side and you pass it over. When you have a partnership, you really are doing a warm handoff, right? And even better if they can come to you or if you can go to them.
Thank you, Lydia. Anyone else in the panel would like to take that question? Sammy?
Just a shout out to corporate partnerships can be really beautiful opportunities of collaboration. We've talked a lot about like the community based, and I think, you know, all of us working to link to each other is so important. And then also, like, we have a corporate partner who comes in every Pride and they, you know, host a educational event with our clients, and they bring, you know, provide, you know, that connection to community. So I think having partners, not just within the homeless service nonprofit world, but also partners outside who can bring your employees time and talent to help us, is really important.
Thank you, Sammy. Erica?
Yeah, absolutely. We rely upon our partners. The problems are huge and we certainly can't solve them ourselves. We operate, you know, we have services across multiple service areas. So, you know, there's the housing and homeless space, but there's also Family Resource Center. There's 26 family resource centers across San Francisco, so that's its own space. And then early childhood education is totally its own space, and behavioral health. So we're fortunate to have a policy team. Otherwise, there's no way that we could, you know, cover all the ground. And, you know, just want to, there was an article that you might have seen today in the Standard about, you know, that kind of old hack about there's so many nonprofits. Why, you know, why are there so many and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I just want to give a shout out to, yes, there are a lot of nonprofits. They do all different things. And this is like working with people and trying to create individualized solutions and having like one massive organization that, you know, great, we can consolidate. It's not, that doesn't make sense. It's not going to work. And why this keeps on coming up is really frustrating. You know, if we're going to be doing work where we're trying to, you know, be individualized and take care of people, smaller organizations that work together in collaboration is the way to go. So
thank you. Anyone else? Mary?
I'll just add on the partnership side. I mean, it is essential for Miracle Messages. We have to be partnering with local organizations, with the government, with corporations, that we are in addition to the other services that are being provided around homelessness. Like addressing the relational supports is a key and add-on to the other services that are provided for people around their homeless navigation. And then I just want to, again, like, it is essential for us to be partnering with our housed community members, and they are a key piece of this puzzle and a key piece of the solution. They can both like support and be a part of the solution, and they can also block you in trying to make decisions around homeless services. And so it is an invaluable part of the picture. So.
Thank you, Mary. Any other questions from the audience? So please just let everyone know who you are and what organization.
My name is Rebecca, and I'm with Community Forward SF. My question is a little broader. I respect and appreciate that none of our panelists really touched the question around the upcoming election. potential propositions. My question for any of these panelists are, what do they do to sort of counter the negative narrative around homelessness and the general fatigue that is felt? One of our panelists did mention, not in my neighborhood. And so as the need is so great and it is at its highest, how do we as nonprofits or as organizations that are serving, how do we combat that sort of negative general, you know, narrative and fatigue to, in order to be able to expand?
Thank you. Great question. Who on the panel would like to take that one? Go ahead, Mary.
So I think as an organization, a key component of our organization is narrative change. And so really looking at how do we change the hearts and minds of our house community members around the face of homelessness, around the homeless component of the work, around homelessness itself. And that is through volunteering, getting to know our unhoused community members. That is through talking to individuals who are unhoused to understand the complexities around homelessness. And then we also provide storytelling and sharing information about people's experiences. And our organization can do so much. And it's also for us as community members, it is our responsibility to get to know the complexities around homelessness, to get to know the policies that are the propositions that are in front of us, around the mayoral candidates that are in front of us, and ask ourselves really difficult questions about what does that mean? What is not being spoken about? What is being put in front of us? And to ask those difficult questions right now. So,
Lydia?
Yeah, I mean, don't go on Twitter. That would be one. I used to engage, and then it was like, you know, you can only be called names so many times and murderer and this, that, and the other. But, you know, working with people who use drugs and creating a caring environment for them while they're using drugs and, you know, providing them with healthcare that they need while they're still using drugs, you know, with the goal to be to create a healthier life for that individual, to give them opportunities for a healthier life, which may include abstinence. It's really challenging because the narrative is really hard. You know, it's that these people are XYZ. I don't even say it anymore because it's pointless. But it's almost like one person at a time. At some point you put your blinders on and you just do the work. Because if I get involved with every person who, you know, I mean, denying science, there is scientific evidence to harm reduction and to treatment and to homelessness and all of these things. There's scientific evidence. And whether you're denying climate change or you're denying harm reduction, you know, once you get into a person who is absolutely 100% like, no, it doesn't work. They're just X, Y, and Z. And therefore they should be sent off to prison, and get into this authoritarian kind of like this viewpoint, you're not going to change that person. So move on. Move on to the next person. And the other thing is volunteerism, you know, and, you know, I remember, you know, when I go to sort of corporate venues to talk about volunteerism, you know, I try to say like, you know, the group volunteerism is great. However, I recommend that a person pick an organization with a mission that speaks to them and volunteer for a year, because become part of the community, get to know the people that you're interested in. You know, you can go and paint a wall, and that's great. It's helpful. But actually getting to know people changes hearts and minds. And then the other thing I was just going to say is our mission has to include all the people in the community, right? We are there. Our mission is to serve the folks who are coming to us for safe space. And in order for our space to continue to be safe, we have to be welcomed in the community. And so, like, I'm having tea tomorrow with a guy who regularly on the weekend sends me hateful texts about our organization and the people we serve, you know? And I'm like, let's go have coffee. You know, I mean, like, you have to engage. You just have to engage. And it's part of the work, you know? And it's like, you get a patina and you put on your armor and you go to work. And that's, you know, and then when you get home, hopefully you can take it off.
Thank you, Lydia. Anyone else? Erica?
Well, I can say, first of all, working in family homelessness, you know, we have an advantage that you know that we are absolutely going to be exploiting for fundraising because people, you know, respond differently to children and babies. But, you know, you still wind up in those conversations where you're saying, well, this is our population. And we are always really careful to make sure that we say, and no one should be homeless, everyone's experience. And, you know, we don't want to ever have one population pitted against another population. I'm just going to add to that. You know, you wind up in conversations where you can also do that educating and reminding people that, you know, if you don't help these kids when they're kids, the chances are that they're going to be homeless as adults. Like, that's the biggest indicator of adult homelessness is childhood homelessness.
Thank you, Erica. So I'd like to wrap up the show by asking each of you how folks who are here in the audience today and also watching and listening can support your work, get engaged in your work. So I'm going to start with you, Mary.
You can come to our website, miraclemessages.org, and you can support us as a volunteer to get more information about resources that are available, or we also are always looking for some financial support too. So through all those different mechanisms. So.
Sammy?
Similar response, our website, communityforwardsf.org. We are always looking for partners. We have an upcoming end of year holiday campaign, so we're looking for, if you like doing kind of like crowdfunding or fundraising within your community, we also love coming to your place of work and educating. I think education is really important to humanize homelessness and help your community understand the problem. So we would love to partner and come to your space.
Thank you, Sammy. Erica?
So our website is compass-sf.org. We love financial donations. We also seek volunteers, and we have lots of different opportunities working with our families. And then we have two events that are coming up, one on November 3rd. We've created this Families for Families event, and it was in response to the fact that there are a lot of people out there in the community who have kids, and they want to engage their kids and, you know, build the next generation of philanthropy, and we're like, we're here to help. So, but there, you have to find ways to do that are appropriate and not intrusive to the population that you're working with. So it's a day where people can come with their kids and they do all these things. They build lasagnas and apple crisps and do other things. And all of those get frozen and taken to our residential sites. And we do a little bit of education for the families. And it's kind of headed by a youth committee of 4th to 6th graders who are like really powerful and amazing. So we have that. And then we do a very big, kind of almost industrial sized adopt a family initiative over the winter holidays. We have like well over 500 families that get adopted by donors in the community that can be like work partners or corporations or families or anyone. It's also a nice kind of family friendly thing that you can get your kids involved in, and you get a wish list from a family, a little bit of information about them, and you do shopping for them. And it's, you know, the toys and the things that kids want, but also like clothing that families need and household items and all that. And all of that you can sign up for on our website. Given the way our numbers are growing, our need is also growing on that front, and we don't want to disappoint our families.
Thank you, Erica. And Megan?
Thank you. Well, that sounds delightful. So Simply the Basics website is simplythebasics.org. We are small, privately funded, so donations really do make a tremendous difference. We are also community-based, so volunteerism makes a tremendous difference. We have a platform on the website called the Hygiene Locator. I mentioned it a little earlier, but if you would like to donate products directly to a site where people are going, just hop on that website. Whatever products you might already have on hand, or maybe you're going to stop at a store and search, you can just put in that you're a donor, and it will pull up the organizations, including how to appropriately donate them so that you're not burdening an organization, like their drop-off times, how to make an appointment, things like that. So that's a really way that you can continue to spread that need. I would do a disservice to how hard our volunteer team works on creating our social media. We are very small, but most people in need learn about us on social media. So if you could follow us on Facebook or Instagram, our advisory committee of volunteers who are people lived experiences, I promised I would make sure to ask you all to follow. They're telling their stories. They're sharing the services that we do. But I do get emails when they're like, we got 5 follows today. So follow along. It's how a lot of people learn about us. And I know I would be very grateful.
Thank you, McKen. And Lydia.
So our website is the Gubbio, G-U-B-B-I-O project.org. And we gratefully accept donations. We love to have individual volunteers. We're too small for really group volunteers, but folks come in and serve coffee. Folks come in and help just being present when people are sleeping. People come in and do all different kinds of services, including organizing our donations. Currently, our church, like, there was a fire a few months back, and so the church is being repainted and corrected, and so our folks are outside, sleeping outside right now on the cot. So we need blankets. If there was one thing I would ask for, it's blankets, and we are at the corner of 15th and Julian between Valencia and Mission. We're open right now from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m., so blankets, blankets, blankets. Right now, we can't accept other donations because we just don't have the space because we're not able to be in the church. But yes, come on by. We're a wonderful community. People really enjoy their time with us, and we have really good, freshly roasted coffee that comes every week from a local vendor. So come on by and spend some time with the community.
Thank you. So I want to thank all of our panelists today for participating in our panel and our wonderful audience members. And thank you all for everything that you do.
We hope you found today's panel discussion on homelessness in San Francisco informative and inspiring. The organizations represented here are doing crucial work to support those experiencing homelessness and advocating for systemic change. To learn more about each organization featured in the panel and find out how you can support their work through donating or volunteering, please visit voicesofthecommunity.com, click on Making the Invisible Visible to explore episode 2 and listen back to part 1 of our conversation in episode 1. While you're on our website, you'll find links to each organization's website as well as resources and information on how to get involved. As you explore more about each organization, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter to stay in the loop on our upcoming series, resources, and opportunities to participate in our next live show. We've also created a YouTube playlist featuring our past interviews with each organization participating in today's live panel show, which you can find on voicesofthecommunity.com in the Making the Invisible Visible series inside of our episodes 1 and 2 webpage. Or simply search George Koster on YouTube to dive into the playlist and learn more about each organization's unique approach and contributions to supporting our unhoused neighbors. Remember, together, we can make a difference in the lives of those experiencing homelessness and create a more just and compassionate community for all. Today's episode was made possible through our amazing technical crew, audio and video wizard Eric Strada, and our co-production partner, Bayvac Media, and their wonderful team, Paula Argoni, Andy Kunami, Siobhan Giles, and Clay Goh. And thanks to Casey Nance from Citron Studios for the graphics magic. A special thanks to our broadcast partners who help share these important conversations, KSFP LPFM in San Francisco, KPCA LPFM in Petaluma, Petaluma Community Public Access TV, and Bayvac Media's SF Commons Public Access TV. Thank you for your commitment to amplifying diverse voices and perspectives. Please support these partners and our mission by tuning in and spreading the word. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. We're also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org, and we'd love your support to continue to make shows just like this one. Go to georgekoster.com and click on the donate button. Take Voices of the Community with you on the go. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Enjoying the show? Please rate and review us. It helps more people discover these important stories. Watch past and future episodes on YouTube by searching for Geo Koster. Have feedback or ideas? We'd love to hear from you. Email george@georgekoster.com. I'm George Koster from San Francisco. On behalf of our team, thank you for joining us. Until next time, remember, your voice matters.